Hi, this is Natu, a guy who's way too old and way too long involved in this game, and you're watching Thorin's YouTube channel.
Right, this is going to be another episode of Reflections, and this one is, of course, going to be with the return guests, since I've done a bunch of these original over the years. Every 2 or 3 years we do one. I obviously thought this one was particularly apt, since, as we will get to in the interview, the headline, it's not really the headline, but we all know it's how he spots works, is, you're retiring! You said you retired, like, which we all know it's not quite as simple as that, but that's the big picture. So yeah. We all know where we're coming in at. Is maybe this is the last one, who knows, right? So where I want to start, Richard, is unsurprisingly in the domain of esports journalism. Like, obviously there's going to be a bunch of questions about this topic. So one thing I thought I would ask about is this, is it's not as simple as like, oh, if you don't like the new things, you just hate progress and you're a boomer and stuck in the past. Like, I know that's the angle that all the young people will all take, but one angle along those lines that it cannot be true surely is, right? I'm not really nostalgically thinking of the old journalists in esports. Like, look, even the ones I've had my issues with, people like Slasher, they were among the best in the world. They were really good at what they did. I even know behind the scenes sometimes they did kill stories when they didn't have the source of that. So essentially, my question to you is this. Does it concern you, or what do you think of the fact that the current class or generation of journalists coming through, I would say in the last couple of years, like the joke is, there doesn't really almost, there's like the odd person who's trying to be the old school real journalist. Now it actually seems like the joke is there is no tabloid anymore. Tabloid is a pipeline to being what event, like put it this way, Richard. My prediction is literally within the next 5 years, either literally Jake Lucky or all those anonymous leaker guys, when they become non-anonymous, will win the Journalist of the Year award. I believe that will that is the future of journalism, in my opinion, because that is the pipeline. The pipeline is you start as the Twitter guy and the sort of not so legit one. And then once you get enough connections that you sort of get closer, it feels like you just get moved up and they tell you, right, put your real name, right, here's an editor, and eventually you're just going to become, so essentially, like, is this just what esports journalism is now? Am I missing something? It feels like this is what the new angle is.
Well, so guys like Jake Lucky and those that kind of class of journalists, we use him obviously as an example because he's one of the most popular at the moment.
For sure,
For me, it's not so much that they are something other than a tabloid. It's they're the evolution of what tabloids were originally meant to be, and they're just updating it for the social media era. I don't think what Jake Lucky does, like, has zero value, for example. You know, like, the whole point of tabloids, for those that don't know, they used to be these compressed tablets, like, that medicine you used to get. And they were, like, tablets back then were like horse pills. And so the selling feature were that it was the same medicine, but compressed. I can't remember the company that did it, but it was a London-based pharmaceutical company. And they called them tabloids to sort of separate the idea that you're not getting the big horse pills anymore. You're getting this small condensed version. And then in the 1900s, that word got repurposed essentially to be about the news. And so you've seen the broadsheets that we have now. Well, broadsheets back in the day, broadsheet newspapers were massive, very unwieldy to read. Tabloids were brought in to be like, yes, the word count is reduced, but we're still going to give you the same news quality, and we're going to do it in, because the word count is reduced and we're getting straight to the crux of the matter, we can provide you with a smaller, you know, paper to hold. So that's why they were called tabloids. So what Jake Lucky and those guys are doing is the exact digital evolution of that thought process. People today want, you know, in the attention economy, people want to get to the crux of the news in any given moment. And I can follow Jake Lucky, and there will be a river of shit on his Twitter feed, which can be said for anyone. Twitter's not a great medium. But equally as well, I'll probably know on any given day, what's the drama in live streaming? What's the news from esports? You know, so I don't think his account has no value. Now, is he a great journalist? Well, God forbid that label should ever be applied. That would be an anathema to me personally, because he's doing the type of rewriting reporting. You know, it's almost like re-reporting that has become unbelievably popular to do across all digital outlets, because people don't realize that outside of just being able to find quick, easy, short to read things, it has very little value beyond that. You know, you're not breaking the story, you're not expanding on the story, you're not adding context to the story a lot of the time. Essentially, you're taking a screen, I mean, what Jake Lucky does is takes a screenshot of a tweet, says this person tweeted this, what, you know, and okay, well, if I happen to follow that guy's Twitter account, I would already have seen it. So, you know, it's like, it's not high level work, but there is some value to it in this day and age. Now, in terms of the old school, for me, I think the old school is a little bit over romanticized, honestly. Okay. Like if you go back and, I mean, you know this, the columns that Carmack used to write, they were passable. Like, if we're being honest.
Oh, they're not, they wouldn't look great now. They would age very poorly, obviously, yeah.
Yeah. I was another guy from SK, I remember, Zex, used to have a regular column called The Zex Files, if memory serves me correct. Fantastic name. I mean, my column was called Gonzeria, what the fuck can I say? But, you know, he, again, I think a lot of the writing wouldn't hold up. And I think the guys that actually did good writing generally didn't stay around for all that long. You have to be a bit sick in the head to do it or not be airlifted to a better opportunity. So I do think a lot of the old school is a bit over romanticized. The only difference is at least people were trying to create long form content. Whereas now there seems to be this tacit acceptance that actually kids don't want long form content. They got the TikTok attention spans. So in that environment, what is the point of paying a features writer to write a 3,000, 6,000, 10,000 word article, a series of them? What's the point in paying somebody to do that when in reality you could pay less for somebody to be a Jake Lucky, and if they were popular enough and had enough followers, you would get a much greater return on your money for that?
Is it something where you actually, like, obviously it sounded there like you were a bit wistful of the fact that, like, long-form writing is not really a thing anymore. Some people would say, I mean, I remember thinking this myself this year when you did your pieces again, because you've obviously done way more, like, long-form written pieces than past years. I think the joke is, mate, it's the same for me, myself. I always feel like written format is actually my best field. Like, when I do my best piece in that, I feel like, right, I hit the highest high. Obviously, you have the most control because it doesn't have the same time component of a video. You can be very careful with your words. But as you say, I do sort of feel like the audience for it is way more diminished. It's like, at this point, I'd be writing it almost for my own benefit. And that actually just kind of sucked for me because it almost makes me think, like, well, I mean, put it this way, all I ever think is this. It's way easier to do the exact same topic as a video because you can make like a million mistakes. You can be slapdash with it. And if you miss a point, whatever, I'll get it next time. You know, like it feels like that in general, that like medium switch has also like degraded the quality of the work, if you know what I mean, or what expectation. So is this something that annoys you? Because I know, like as I say, most people would say you're writing some of the best work that you do, right?
Well, yeah, but you have to, you know, even when I'm critical, I try and be reflective, because the last thing you want to do is be the boomer. You know, like, you don't want to be that guy who only listens to Led Zeppelin, you know, and says music died after Led Zeppelin or whatever, you know, like, so journalism died after our era, you know. I'm always looking at the evolving fields, and I'm paying very close attention to shorts and seeing whether they are a vector for good work, education and information, or whether they're just going to be a hotbed for clout chasing misinformation spreaders. I am leaning towards the latter, but I keep an open mind. I think long form writing will always be valued because it's essentially an art form, mainly fiction writing, obviously not so much journalism, but good journalism that tells a compelling story can be obviously as engaging as a really, you know, great work of fiction too. So I think there will always be value in it. It's just whether our audience is going to want to consume a lot of that in the coming years, I don't know. To the counterpoint of that, at least the good news is in esports, we do have now fans in their 30s, in their 40s, which is totally new. People who've literally grown up with esports, people who have like wives and kids of their own now and watching them get into new esports. And I think the overall age of our audience has increased. And generally, it is an older audience that is going to be more interested in consuming the type of, you know, work that we create. So there's that. I'm always going to be a bit sad if long-form writing was to kind of fall out of favor and fashion, and it definitely feels that it has to a certain degree. I think I've written some like pretty compelling long-form stories and article series this year. But the interesting part is a lot of people have either missed it or didn't want to engage with it or read the headline and then completely just assumed and invented the rest of the work in their minds and then complained about that. So, yeah, the classic. I mean, I've noticed that happening a lot more, I must say, recently.
Along the lines of talking about like the newer generation, the next class of people coming through, the other concern I had is this. It's not just that they start as sort of like half journalists or like just leakers and like the standards law. The other thing that concerns me, and I guess it, in some sense it goes hand in hand, it's just to them they're not explicitly thinking this, is a lot of them just don't seem to think there even is such a thing as journalistic ethics, if you know what I mean. Like, I remember years and years ago, we're talking a long time ago, when you did a show with Jason Lake, when he did that like business show about esports, and I remember on this show you actually gave me a compliment. This is like a long time ago, it was maybe like 2015 or something, and you actually said one of the things that you appreciated about my work was I had a good understanding of journalists ethics. But here's what you might not know, because I'm not journalistically trained, I've never pretended to be someone who like knew all the like, so I learned stuff like that from like the way you do socially. I picked up things watching, looking at your work, or I remember many times I've heard like Christopher Hitchens wax lyrical about why you've got to do this thing this way, or give people their due, or the concept of like a right to a reply and things like that. You know, like I learned it from picking up, you know, socially seeing what the other top people are doing. So the concern I have is, I wonder if this is connected in some way, because in the new generation it feels like they almost think that's outdated, and that actually now, you know, being some sort of just media entity is where it's at, and they play very fast and loose with the ethics. Because again, the people who I genuinely think, if this was 10 years ago and they're in the old industry, people who I might now be put at odds with because of these issues, like the Bloops of the world, I actually think if you look at like the work they do that's good, they would have just come up through the normal system and become like a legit person like Jacob Wolf. Whereas now it feels like, because their fan bases and their sort of following they have, it almost, the messaging is like, we don't care if they get it wrong, and we don't really care if there's a little, you know, if they step over the line a little bit here and there, as long as they give us the juice and as long as the story, you know, it's like mainly true. Like, they almost treat it like you've got to stick up your ass, that you're like, what the fuck, he's like violated ethics here, or did he have another source, you know? What do you think on this topic? Because it feels like that's something that very much feels like they think it's a thing of the past.
Journalists, a lot of digital journalists, and this isn't just in esports by any means, because, you know, you look at like someone like Taylor Lorenz, for example, and you know, they're a prime example of everything that's wrong with the modern digital journalist, where they use journalism to insert themselves into a scene, but what they're really doing is they want to be an influencer. It's what they really want to do, but they can't for whatever reason. You know, they're anonymous, or they're too old in Taylor's case, or, you know, they don't have a broad skill set, or they're just not charismatic enough. You know, whatever it might be, that's what they want to be. And so they subvert journalism norms to basically become a kind of pseudo influencer, essentially. And, you know, I mean, the guys that we're talking about, the fucking anonymous Pokemon, you know, leaker accounts, and I'm not just talking about one specifically. I mean, there was that weird trend that came up for a while. You know, those people don't want to be journalists. As soon as they encounter any pushback, any requirement for transparency, any negativity, you'll notice they'll all peace out and do something else. Often they'll repurpose their accounts. Right, this is now a Formula One fan account. Deal with it, you know, and hope their audience come along for the ride. What they really wanted wasn't to do good work. It was just to build influence and clout. Again, that clout seeking, that addiction to cloutium that we see. But the other aspect of this, of course, is when it comes to the ethical component of it. Obviously people that view it this way, that don't think of themselves as being journalists, they're going to color outside of the lines a little bit. And, you know, what you'll notice is one of the things I have never done in my career and will never do, I have zero interest in pandering to anybody. But pandering is a key component of how you become a successful influencer. And so what happens is these journalists, they get a story wrong. You know, again, we can use, I believe it was Wulu that did this. They get a story wrong and then they throw a source under the bus and go, whoopsie, my source completely fed me bullshit. It was all his fault. And it's like, hang on. You're the person supposed to vet the source. You do realize that, right? Like, if your source is wrong, that's a reflection on you. You know, if you run with the story, not a reflection on the source. You know, you don't get a pass if you say, oh, my information was bad, yet you vetted the information and uncritically repeated it. Your failure, your bad as the journalist. But because if you have a history of pandering to your audience, to your readers, to your viewers, what they'll do is they'll go, don't worry, get them next time, King. Big W for admitting you were wrong, even though, of course, they're not admitting they were wrong. They're actually blaming someone else for being wrong. So the pandering is an essential component of this, which I regularly tell fans, like, you're just not stupid. You're too stupid, you know, for what I'm saying. You're not even reading what I'm saying. Fuck off. I tell, you know, a lot of my work is uncomfortable truths that I think need to be said about the industry, which fans just don't want to hear, you know, things that are going on in an organization, current state of play in an e-sport, you know, blood money coming in, developers doing bad things, you know. This is the type of stuff I write about. No one wants to hear it. Whereas, you know, what a lot of these other journalists will do is they'll pick a side, they'll pick a point they want to get to that they know their readers, listeners would like to hear, and you work your way backwards with the story, you know. Right. So you sort of reverse engineer it that way for the purposes of pandering and popularity. So that's the bigger problem. It's not that these people are getting things wrong, although they do seem to have a higher average of incorrect stories than when we were around doing it on the regular. But it's not so much that you get them wrong. Every journalist should get them wrong. We've always had an impossibly high standard in esports where the expectation is 100% or you're a hack. That's nonsense. But what bothers me most of all is the type of story they report, the fan interaction, and how they're essentially more interested in being popular than being right, more popular than being productive in terms of telling the types of story that might move the industry forward. That's a much bigger problem.
This ties in as well, though, to another phenomenon I've noticed, and we'll certainly come back to this later, maybe along other lines in esports. But for journalists, the area I've noticed this is, there is a very strange phenomenon. I thought you'd be a great person to ask, because I've always told you, for real, I know everyone says to you, write a book about esports. The joke is, the book I want you to write, for real, is just social media, like your insights on it, your observations, because we've just been around and we've had so many interactions.
I've already started it. I've got a few chapters under my belt. You just obviously
would have your own perspective on it. I could see how you could draw your different strands in. So the question I have along these lines goes like this. The phenomenon is this, right? When it, as you say, if it's me or you, or it's DK or George Geddes, basically the people who are considered like the legit journalists who are trying to uphold ethics and have like the best track record and always get it right. And if you're wrong, admit it, right? The ones who try to do that, Richard, the phenomenon is this. They are held, as you say, to an absolutely impossible standard. You're never ever allowed to be wrong once. If you are, it's not, well, 99% record's pretty good. It's this one time he's wrong proves he is a liar, is trash, it was all made, right? They take this crazy angle, but as you've implied there, if you come from the world of the tabloid style, I'm the leaky guy, even if eventually one day you put yourself literally side by side with me, you're right next to George Geddes on like an eSports Journalist of the Year award list, even though you're in the same category or his peer, they'll never treat that guy with, as you say, they never hold that guy to that standard. So can you give me your thoughts? It's obviously clear they're not just doing it because they care about esports. What's the angle here as to why a certain group is held to the impossible standard? The other one, it's almost like they find it funny that they don't have to make that guy jump through the hoops.
Well, it's back to the pandering. It all comes back to that. That, remember, the fans that you deal with in esports are, you know, they're somewhere worse than sports fans, not quite as bad as K-pop fans. You know, so that's kind of what you're dealing with in esports. They're not a particularly well-informed, fan base. They're not particularly, mature, even by the developmental standards, you would expect. There's a lot of, like, people, like, I mean, I had this the other day, like, a 19-year-old was going, I was just a teenager at 19. Like, bro,
I know.
I was on my way out, you know. It was a fucking uni, living alone. I've been living alone for 3 years by that point. What the fuck are you talking about? Anyway, you know, I don't know if that's like a bigger reflection on society and just we live longer. Maybe the arrested development period, it's okay to be longer. But there is an unbelievable level of immaturity. And the things that they, say, they don't really mean and they don't really understand a lot of the time. So when they're like banging on George, who, you know, with some of the tweets he makes, he is his own worst enemy sometimes. I think he's borderline on that trap.
He's put himself in the middle, hasn't he? He sort of tries to play for them sometimes, and then sometimes he tries to be legit, you know.
It's like, if you want an example of how to be a clout chaser without revealing that you are a clout chaser, you do what Fionn on Fire does. and you just basically put out very generic, bland tweets like, who do you think's the best League of Legends player in the world? And all the engagement follows. And of course, you're not doing that because you don't have your own ideas or you genuinely want to know. You're doing that because that tweet will get retweeted and get engagement and you'll gain followers and therefore a large readership, you know? But he never does anything that's contentious, whereas George will do that but also say things that are like, you know, pretty iconoclastic, pretty divisive. But regardless, the point is this. If you pander to the fans, if you say, like, ridiculous things on a daily basis, like, oh, it's all about the fans. I wouldn't be here for the fans. I do it all for the fans. Unironically, my work is for the fans. But fuck them. They're also their own worst enemy as well. Like, I mean, I'll do the work. It's there for you. When you reject it, I'm just going to think you're an idiot. And then do on to the next story. But you get a lot of people, as I say, because they're on that influencer bullshit. What they say is they go like, you know, oh, you're so good, you're so bad. They're interacting with people on Twitter like, I'm so sorry. And if you just show, like, false contrition all the time, even when there's no need to apologize, if you just, like, seem a bit pathetic and never stand up for yourself, oh, the internet laps that up. They love it. And so, you know, you will notice the way that standard is applied has got nothing to do with the type of work you do, nothing to do with the type of journalism you do, nothing to do even with, like, your personality in a lot of way, because, I mean, I say it a million times, I'll say it to my dying day, social media is not a window into someone's soul, no matter how much you want to make it that. So it's just applied based on who panders to the fans the most. Same with players, you know, same with everything. So it's sad that journalism has become so overtly dependent, fan dependent, that there's a cult of personality around journalists now, or people, you know, that are on that cusp of being journalists or wannabe journalists or misrepresenting themselves as journalists. But that's just the same as esports. Esports and streaming influence culture just got atoms smashed together sometime in, like, you know, 2017, and it's poisoned everything.
One of the things I thought I would ask about in terms of the topic of why ethics essentially within journalism or why, like, a professional standard is important, I'll just give an example of my own career in this sense, which is I used to, just like a lot of people, I think this is actually, in my opinion, why they don't learn this stuff and they just think, like, what the hell, why am I being attacked for just doing my job? I think they really believe, right, that if you're just I'm a good guy, like, that's enough. Like, you know, you just try, yeah. I'm trying my best, you know, I'm not mean or anything. They don't understand, like, the reason you need these standards. I would actually describe it, no joke, like, if you think of jobs where it's like actual physical labor, where you have to have standards for safety reasons, like plumbing or fucking electricity or something, where obviously if you leave like just a cable out, someone could touch that, get electrocuted. If you don't put like the cover back on something, someone could touch a burning hot pipe, right? The reason you have those standards is to safeguard you and the people who are working with you. So what I would say is this, what I actually learned was, it's not as simple as just like, right, this is just what people who did like a degree in journalism do to show you that they did the degree and you didn't, because they know, like, you know, it's not like some deep law. This stuff's actually really important. Like, explain it this way. I actually found through the process of learning journalistic ethics and trying to see, like, right, so I have to always do it through this, like, filter system. I can't, like, do it wrong in this way or take a shortcut here. What I found was, it actually, the joke is, I thought initially that just protects the work. It protects you. It makes you always have to be legit and think, fuck, yeah, I can't do that though. In fact, one of the areas that's protected me the most is things like Twitter. Like, you'll notice I'm really careful, even though tweets are not my journalism. I do on Twitter try to hold that standard. That, like, the famous example I always tell you is, I will never say Flusher cheated, because I cannot know that. I will always say I think he cheated. And to a fan, they don't know the distinction, but I think that distinction is enormous. So the point I'm getting to is this, right? Like, I'll give you an example right now. We're doing this recording just after the World Cup final, right? This is even something I've found safeguards your thinking, mate. So I always tell people, when it comes to things like when I did those, like, world rankings, I used to do that, like, 3 month span with this criteria. I thought all the criteria up before I ever did one, because what I realized is, if I don't do that, then since I'm still going to be fine-tuning it, there's going to be that time, isn't there, where maybe back in the day I was a fan of Titan and I'm like, well, I haven't quite defined the criteria. I could maybe squeeze them up to 5, or don't really like, I'll pick a random team. Flip side, maybe they go down to 9, because, you know, human nature, it's so tempting, isn't it, when you don't have the sort of strict rules. So I'll give you the example I was going to give today, because I think this is a great example, even though people won't like it, which is, if you are a Lionel Messi fan, by the way, I'm a Lionel Messi fan. The problem I have is I just also despise the way a lot of Lionel Messi fans argue. Yes. So, like a lot of fan bases, they annoy me. So it'll seem like I don't like the player. If you know me, I like all great players. It's nothing to do with that. But what I'll say is this, you'll have seen this. The second Argentina won, every comment was, that cements Messi as the GOAT. Now, the problem, and you'll know where I'm going with this, is if Portugal had won, would a single Messi fan say that cements Ronaldo's the GOAT? If the answer is no, by the way, then logically, they never had actually a principle as to what cements you as the GOAT. Now, look, it's if they'd have said Lionel Messi's play in this World Cup cement, that would be a very good way to like distinguish it, but they wouldn't do that. The point is, they were just waiting. At the end, confirmation bias tells them he must be the GOAT because I like him and he's just won the big tournament, so that's it. So the point I was getting to like at the beginning is, this isn't just some fuddy-duddy thing from the past where we're like, just do a tradition for no reason. I actually think, for real, it can actually change your whole life, understanding these ethics and principles. I actually think it makes you a better person in a way.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And I think as well, just like I say, it's super important to have guardrails because it's very easy to let them slip when you're dealing with stories. You know, you have to look at these things from both sides. Like, somebody might be doing some very heinous shit, but if your source on that heinous shit, the person telling you, if it cannot be verified and it's not 100% reliable, then I can't publicly make the allegation. I can't roll the dice on someone's life, you know, like, that's fucked up. Like, but unfortunately, as we know, we've seen plenty of people in the digital journalist space do this. And let me tell you, if it's something serious, if it's something important, then you can never wind that back. Like, you really can't. You can say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, I retract the story. Nah. The way it works now, the initial allegation gets all the noise, all the sound, all the fury, and the reality gets none of the attention, you know? And I've seen this, you know, around, you know, allegations that have been made about people's conduct online. I've seen it in real crazy things. Like, I mean, I interviewed Keemstar because I wanted to give him a platform with a credible journalist so he could essentially talk it out. When he had said about that old, who's sadly passed away now, but the old RuneScape streamer that he falsely accused on Drama Alert of being a pedophile. I mean,
fucking hell.
Yeah, he said, you know, it wasn't his story, and he's just the host of the show, and he just read it, and they fired the news writer that researched it. It was literally just based on looking on two pictures. That was it. And you know, that old guy's life was ruined. I mean, you can't even imagine. He was just a dude in his, I believe, in his late 50s at the time. He passed away this year, I think, with a tumor in his early 60s. And, you know, he was just a nice old dude that streamed RuneScape, that was kind of remarkable in the streaming space because of his age, but he played RuneScape since the game had come out. And, you know, and he was just a kindly old man who just liked to stream video games to a very small audience. And Keemstar blew him up saying he was a pedophile. And, you know, you can't even imagine what that does to someone. And it's like all the apologies in the world are never going to make up for that trauma. I mean, even up until the last time he talked about it, he said, like, that's the worst thing that ever happened in his life. You know, imagine that, you know, like, so, yeah, the guardrails that you put up will protect you from doing accidental cruelty, inexplicably horrible things. It'll prevent you from doing harm to people that don't deserve it. And the sad reality is, yes, you might occasionally have to watch bad people get away with doing bad things that you've got a hunch and a gut feeling about that they did. But you're a journalist. You chose this. A hunch and a gut feeling cannot be enough to impugn somebody's reputation. So I think, you know, like, journalistic ethics in general, I think if you apply that thinking to other aspects of your life, it'll definitely be, it can only be a good thing. I take it super seriously. I never color outside of the lines on a story. I've had to let big ones slip through my fingers. But at the end of the day, like, I feel that's why I've got the record I've got. That's why I've done the work I've done. And, yeah, I think, unfortunately, that this next generation of untrained, unconcerned clout chasers, I think you're going to see some pretty big misses coming from them, which are going to have, you know, broad, wide-reaching consequences for whoever they write about.
Because one area that I actually see this having major parallels to mainstream journalism and the sort of transition from the old type of beat writer journalist to the media influencer that I definitely see taking a parallel in esports in this sense is the idea of, like, when you're describing there, like, you find a story and the initial thing is some salacious or scandalous aspect, like as you're saying, maybe this person's a paedophile, or obviously examples would be like they have some sexual misconduct, or yep, they're abusive to a woman, or they have a fight with something, you know, things that are obviously would immediately emotionally set someone off and make them think, right, this has essentially, right, in that moment, it's the thing I'm concerned about is that a lot of the newer people seem to veer, like the mainstream journalism, more into almost activism than journalism. Because as you're saying, journalism maintains an element of neutrality within the work that, as you say, even if you might not like that guy, even if you know he's a douchebag and he's looks like he's done something, right, the point is, as the journalist with the ethics, you still have to go, I've got to get it over the line, though. I've got to get it squared away. Yep. I've got to get independent. So, whereas obviously you as a person might just think, fuck it, I have to be the hero. I've got to take this guy down. I'm the hero in the movie. I'm the journalist who's going to fight it down. I feel like that's really dangerous. And I see a lot of that in esports, by the way. Like, I feel like, I mean, it's not just things we've encountered, but a lot of people have. People who are journalists also, they almost think that's an excuse to actually avoid the ethics. Like, I've got to get the guy. I can't let him get away.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't want to say the T word, but I'm going to say the T word. I mean, you know, I've covered this extensively in my political work. And obviously, there were so many people who, rightly or wrongly, thought Trump was such a potential danger to the American political system that, you know, this was openly discussed among journalists, where people were saying things like objectivity is the kind of, like, you know, the crack in the veneer through which someone as, you know, reprehensible as Trump is going to get through. So we shouldn't be objective anymore. In fact, we should all become activists. You know, and of course, the trickle-down effect of, objectivity is not even real anyway, so we shouldn't even bother worrying about aspiring to do it. And, you know, I've seen a lot of this, obviously not about Trump, although fuck knows, he's still the most talked about person on the internet for some reason. But I've seen it in, you know, esports, where, you know, there's people or organizations or entities or whatever that people assume are bad or think are bad, or they've done bad things in the past. And yes, there is this unrelenting desire from people that produce work around, you know, esports to go after them and get them. Catch them out, catch them in a gotcha, go through their old tweets, anything that we can do. You know, I mean, this has happened to you, it's happened to me, it's happened to, you know, anyone that's even borderline contentious and doesn't engage in the great pandering dance that, you know, I was talking about earlier. And why are they doing it? Are they doing it to clean up esports? Nah, of course not. They don't really care about that. While they're focusing on you based on a petty grievance, they're not thinking about all of the other things that are going wrong. I mean, you know, I've talked about this before, when, you know, I was calling out the likes of Kotaku and Polygon and all these mainstream press, while they're writing, and you know, PC Games Zen, who I, you know, successfully got to make a retraction and apologize to me, because what they did was clear defamation, and non-factual. The reality is, while you're going after somebody like me, and I'm sure later when we talk about it, I can list every sin that I'm supposed to have done, and they're all just so unbelievably minor and petty, and what it boils down to is people just don't vibe with me.
Yeah.
Right? And that's fine. You know, but the reality is, while you as a journalist wasting your time going after me, there's no skeletons in the closet, there's nothing fucked up, you know, what you see is what you get. Well, why aren't you writing about the predators and the perverts at Activision Blizzard, right? Why aren't you taking the time to, you know, write up a story about someone's breast milk being stolen out of a fridge? You know, Jason Schreier turned around and said, I'd heard about all of these stories on the day it all come tumbling out. Yes. Well, it's like, I don't know, dog, like, maybe you could have gone a little bit harder in the paint, you know, with that. And you know, what about Riot Games? You know, what about organizations that are exploiting people? What about all the still yet to be talked about Me Toos? Like, you know, when journalists listen to that activist instinct, you better hope that you're targeting the right people. You know, one of my biggest regrets probably early in my career is I think I probably targeted people that realistically weren't all that harmful. You know, what they were doing was quite minor, and while I was doing that, I wasn't paying attention to what these games development companies were doing when I could have been on that beat a lot quicker, a lot sooner, and you know, maybe we would have, you know, shook the tree and one or two of them would have fallen out. So yeah, I mean, I think it's a fool's errand. I think if you let your emotions sink in to what you're trying to do as a journalist, you can be passionate about a story, but if you let that passion overtake your brain because I've got to get this person, I've got to take them down, then you're going to end up doing bad work and you're going to let bad people get away with heinous things.
This is actually specifically what you're talking about. The idea, like, people don't hold, for example, Riot Games really to task, and they pretend they do.
No.
Like, they sort of skipped over that part of the narrative. No, they make it sound, this is one thing I can't handle about that whole story. They really, everyone now tells that story as if what happened was, like, Riot themselves just announced, like, yeah, we're really sorry, we did all these things, but here's our mea. There was never a mea culpa. I mean, we've gone over this a million times, but, like, the joke is they were caught. Even when they were caught, they tried to wriggle out of it and did some dodgy stuff. Somehow that didn't splash back on them. Then they just kept doing it, and then they just went radio silence forever on the top execs, and then basically you had some middle level and lower level people who did like some protests or some like courses or something, and we splash force click your heels three times and apparently it's all fixed. Because the problem with this topic here, Richard, is there's a couple of like very simplistic explanations. So one of them is like, well, they're the ones that have all the money and the power, so everyone's scared to say it. Yeah, I'm sure there's some people there. At one point I actually saw that even people like, I think maybe like Sideshow made that, I just thought was a valid point. I just don't think it explains everything. Is they also pointed out it is a lot easier when you have like a face and a name like Carlos from G2, where you know who he is. You know, it's a lot easier than that than just like Riot. Because yeah, it's true. Just, you know, Riot is just, it's just a monolithic stat. But my problem with that is the reason that can't be it though, and this is what I want to ask about. Essentially, why do the real bad guys? Because what I feel like, I'm going to tie it again into some mainstream stuff here. I feel like it is again like mainstream journalism where it's like a friend enemy distinction, you know, like yes, as long as you are sort of on my team, look, I'll give you the slap on the wrist and I'll say some of the things I have to, but ultimately I will let it slide. Cause the Riot one to me, like that angle from Sideshow makes sense, like for this second, but like, let's be real. The journalists who went and did those stories about what was going on at Riot Games, if they really wanted to, especially since they haven't ever been punished, they could find out who the execs were who were doing these things. They could give us some names. We could have some people that, you know, look, like, put it this way, people go hammers fuck at Mike Morheim because they know his name. They know, he wasn't even, as far as we know, he wasn't even involved with the press mail stuff and that. Like, that was a different level, but because there's a name, people love to mention his name. So why do you think in that sense some of the bad actors do get to skate?
Well, in the games press, I mean, the reason is because it would make for a lot of uncomfortable soul searching. I mean, what you have to understand is those game development companies, I mean, they operate like any big tech company. It's all political. They get in with the journalists. They control them through access. But also, I mean, journalists are just by and large pathetic creatures. The American journalist is an embarrassment. On average these days, they rose to prominence in the blogging era, and they've been picked up by legacy media because people think they might be hip or trendy. They end up on a games beat. They're full of self-loathing to begin with, and a games developer reaches out to them and says, hey, like, you know, do you want access? Want an exclusive interview? Want to see a game before it's, you know, a month before anyone else sees it? Want to know when we're going to shut down Heroes of the Storm? A week in advance, and maybe you might want to tell some people that, but you're not going to because, you know, it would ruin everything else. And that's what they did. It was quite deliberate. You know, I told you the story about the time Activision Blizzard called me up, and they were talking to me about tweets I'd made, and then halfway through the call, it became apparent they were talking about Slasher.
Oh, right.
I had a literal Blizzard executive call me on the phone saying, you know, you could give us a break on these tweets. And I'm thinking, yeah, I criticize the Overwatch League all the time because it's a fucking joke, you know. But like, it, and then when they started going into the tweets, I'm like, I didn't tweet that. And he was going, come on, Rod. And I'm bro, you've got the wrong fucking number. That tells me two things, by the way. That tells me they feel comfortable getting into a conference with Slasher over stuff. But also, they've got my phone number for some fucking reason. Like, you know. So they get in with these journalists, and obviously journalists will have talked to some of the executives that did the bad things. They'll have heard all the stories and, you know, kept it secret because what can you do? don't want to dig too deep. And especially if you work at a games publication, your access is what gets you the salary, essentially. You know, if your access is shut off, if you're blacklisted, let's say like me, you are blacklisted by Activision, Blizzard, and Riot, in the sense that they will, you know, no high ranking executive will speak to me, right? They're never gonna, you know, Mark Merrill's never gonna agree to be grilled by me, right? So what good would I be to PC Gamer when they make so much of the content and so much of the games? You know, so yeah, that's why so many bad guys skate. I remember when I was researching the Ellie Gate story, and yes. For those that don't remember that, you can go watch my videos on it. But basically what happened was they all wrote matching articles about a girl being harassed who didn't even exist, because it just fit the narrative of gamers being, you know, terrible, unwashed incels that would harass any woman that was good at a game. And all the clues, all the evidence was there that, you know, no one's ever seen her, no one's ever talked to her. People have said, yeah, I actually know who it is. It's a guy, and they're doing this. No games journalists dug into it. They went out, they pushed out the stories, and they went with it. And when I was researching that, I actually saw tweets, because I went right back into the tweet history, from some of the journalists that had uncritically written that story. And there they were going, oh, great dinner today with executives, you know? Executives at these games companies. So, I mean, that's why. The journalists will come down on them en masse in a group when somebody else gets it over the line, but nobody, I mean, you have to be a sicko, because you have to be crazy. You're potentially ruining your own career. You know, that's why I'll give a lot of credit to Cecilia. You know, she fucking hates me, probably. But, you know, and made a very public point of calling me out when I did my speech at the Esports Awards. She didn't even want to take a thank you from me or an acknowledgement she should have been nominated. She had to publicly refuse that from me because I'm the bad man, right? But at the end of the day, at least she had the stones, the backbone to try and get a major story about Riot Games over the line in an industry where that can be the death of your career.
Yes. By the way, along these lines, actually, I had a similar question. By the way, if you notice some of the things we're talking about here, and in fact, later I'll even have a question. I won't be explicit, but the topic will be more explicit. Obviously, some of these things relate to a certain incident that I won't use the name of because it's a cursed word at this point in time. But it is weird. The joke is it was the games journalist Vietnam, wasn't it? Everyone knows.
Yeah,
and it was, let's say,
still
it was,
talking about it now.
Yeah, it was sort of around in the 2010s. Let's just say in the middle of it. If that isn't enough clues, then you don't know what I'm talking about anyway, so don't worry about it. If you do, then you know what we're talking about. I genuinely do think this is going to be one of the themes of the interview. Like, no one learned the lessons of that. Like, it's like all the same mistakes have been made in esports, just over a sort of more drawn out time period. Because another thing I've noticed as well, and this is actually an area where I want to get your take on some things. It's happened to you many times, but it's happened to me, obviously, within the last year or so. So people will know the whole thing that happened to me at the end of last year, where basically the whole internet, like, I was just trending. And I was essentially, in the first couple of days, people were... Look, not directly, but in a sense, replying to me and Semler's comments about like the female league in ESL, right? Now, the reason I say it just in the first few days is because they weren't actually like ever reading what we wrote or trying to reply to us or have like a discussion. They were essentially just sort of like doing the equivalent of what you said about an article. They took like some words we'd said and then just decided like, I'm going to respond to that, even if that's not what we were saying. But then the rest of it there became a very interesting phenomenon, which is what it became then was, it's like I just became the person in the literal dictionary. Like, this is a misogynist. And so any person who in any context, Richard, had problems with misogyny just came and told me horrible things. Almost like I was like some fucking scarecrow. And they just, yeah, no. I was like the 2 minutes of hate or something. It was just like, it felt like that. And what was mad about it was, I actually realized quite soon early in that, it's like, I was looking at the accounts like, dude, these aren't even from esports. Like, what? This isn't even an esports thing anymore. And I would look, and eventually it would be accounts where it was only things like, all they do is complain about misogynists on the internet. All they do is look for people that they need to cancel in movies and books. And so the weird thing about it was, like, the joke is, people eventually were saying stuff where, like, there's no way they could even factually think these things are true, Richard. I had just become some sort of placeholder, as Semler had. Like, an example would be, people would tell me directly, it's guys like you who have literally kept down every woman in esports. It's like, that's just so mental as a factual statement, though. You know what I mean? Like, forget characterization and opinion and subjectivity. Like, in that scenario, the joke is, I even saw one person unironically, because remember, we're talking about people who really don't know who I am and barely know what I do in esports. I saw one guy even name check, literally. Guys like you were the reason people like Shox have a hard time in this industry. If people don't know, I literally gave Shox her break in esports. But they don't know this, like, that simple fact. So what? How would you explain this phenomenon in that sense? Because I feel like that, by the way, the reason I tied it into the games journalist Vietnam is because, to me, a big part of that was they were sort of living out their fantasy that they were this, like, righteous journalist who was being hunted by these evil people and everyone shot them. Whether it was true or not, they were essentially, the demand was so high, they just created the supply to make it what they needed to be true. So what do you think of this whole scenario?
Well, a few things. So one, the only thing anybody needs to learn from the journalists Vietnam of 2014 is that it just proves one thing, that any group of self-interested people will flock to form a cabal or a cartel and will abuse any power they have positionally, any status they have, any platform they have, to essentially rewrite history in such a way that will not hold up to any basic scrutiny of the facts whatsoever, and doesn't. And it's frankly embarrassing. I mean, it was one of the first times I'd seen it happen outside of the realm of politics. It was a big scandal, I want to say, back in the Obama years, where they uncovered, I can't remember the name of the scandal, but it was just something like, it was something like leaks or something, whatever. Anyway, they basically found out all the political journalists, all the major publications, were all sat in like a Google email group thing, and would essentially collude on what color the coverage should be from publication to publication. Editors at one publication would tell journalists at another publication, I don't like what you wrote. And that could have wide-reaching implications. Maybe you shouldn't. Say Obama did this or whatever, you know. You're falling in line with Fox News. Very problematic. And anyway, it all came out. And lo and behold, Journalist Vietnam was just essentially a carbon copy of that. And by the way, they're all still doing it. You know, they do it in Slack, they do it in Discord. There's a reason why when someone's the internet villain of the day, you wake up at fucking 8 a.m. and fucking within 5 minutes there's 20 articles about that person. That doesn't happen by accident. But in terms of the lessons learned, they're never going to learn a lesson. They don't think they have to learn a lesson. It's like all of these political journos, you know, they go after the villain of the day, they slam them with lies, they flood the zone with bullshit, and when anybody, by the time you get round to, like, pulling out all the facts and doing the research and calling them out on it, you either put yourself in the crosshairs and you're the right-wing demagogue or whatever, or they've moved on to the next story and no one really gives a shit because the news cycle is just so rapid. In your case, in Semler's case, you broke my golden rule. I've told you it. I know you don't really give a fuck, but the golden rule is this. When a happening is happening, don't talk about the happening, or you become part of the happening. Wait 48 hours, then give your opinion. And by that point, no one cares. You can't become the villain of the day, right? You can't, because you're not in the middle of the fucking cyclone of shit. But, you know, in that instance, You gave the mob essentially the out to not talk about the reality. And that's what they're all looking for. No one wants to talk about the real shit. No one wants to talk. Like with that league, GG for all, no one wants to have a scientific, rational discussion about, is esports similarly affected as, you know, sports that have a physical element? What's the research on it? What are the scientific papers? Also, what are the numbers? Do we know that having spaces for women to play esports with other women, do we know that that actually raises the level, creates an aspirational element that they'd eventually want to go do it in mixed leagues? What about the weary cynicism of a Saudi Arabian-owned company muddling through through the sponsorship deal with a company like, you know, Intel and the AnyKey pledge, who surely their values aren't compatible with the Saudi Arabian values. But no, what ended up being presented, of course, is his two guys saying things we don't like. We can fucking dumpster them for, you know, as long as it takes. So moving on from that, right? I mean, I think overall, it's right, it's a lot harder to attack something that has a power base to it. Like, nothing I say about Saudi Arabia will stop the way the Saudi Arabian state operates. Nothing I say about ESL will make them revoke that deal and say, you know what, guys, Richard Lewis has written so many heinous articles about me. I'm never, we've just got to stop it. I can't live with that. I can't sleep at night knowing Richard Lewis doesn't like us. That's not going to change anything. But what I'm trying to do, who I'm trying to reach, is I'm trying to make the audience more conscientious. I'm trying to make the fans more conscientious, that understand when you put a penny into that pot, where it's actually going and what it's actually enabling and what it's actually doing. That, to me, is a lot harder because you've got a very big, scary entity that can come after you with very serious career ramifications. For example, much like yourself, I've had to rule myself out of working with ESL. Now, spoiler, ESL would love to work with me in some capacity. That shouldn't surprise anybody. Even back when we were doing the PGL event, I was talking to a few people like, oh, maybe we could work something out. Didn't know they were going to get bought by Saudi Arabia. That for me is a deal breaker. Right, it's just that simple. That's that personal decision, tens of thousands of dollars, it's fine. I'll lose no sleep. Like, it's fine. Like, I'm all right with it. I don't really care. But it's still scary because ESL control 80% of the esports calendar in CS. ESL now have connections to this huge wealthy entity. They could buy up media sites. They could buy up HLTV, right, tomorrow. They could buy, you know, they could buy any news outlet. They could do anything they want. And all of a sudden, if you're in their crosshairs, what are the ramifications for that? I'm not even going to get into the notion that I could get Khashoggi'd. I think that's a bit serious. But, you know, just letting everybody know, the Saudi Arabian state did have a journalist extrajudicially murdered, and the American government has given them immunity from prosecution for that. Right? I mean, that's the type of people that are now in esports. So that's scary to write about them. What isn't scary is to pick an individual who doesn't have a power structure, who is reliant on the popularity and the good graces of board members, employers, sponsors, and completely fucking demonize them by giving a very uncharitable reading of something they've said in a medium that makes everybody look inherently stupid. That's easy. And the best part about it, everyone will cheer you on and join in, because we all love recreational outrage. We all love to have the villain of the day on Twitter. It's no coincidence why there's always someone you can dunk on. There's always someone you can hate. You can always be screaming at the TV, crossing your arms for 15 minutes. Get it out your system. And there are zero consequences for it. It doesn't make the internet a better place. It doesn't improve anything. It's not constructive. By its definition, it's destructive. Even when we're talking about genuine pieces of shit, by the way, which often we're not. But it's just an easy thing to do. You will get clicks and engagement if you're a journalist driving it. You will get the plaudits of your fellow journalists, and you will get in the good graces of all the slimy, evil corporations that are so grateful that they're not the villain of the day when all they do typically is generate negative headlines. So that's why people do it. And yeah, to the earlier point, they're not interested in learning lessons. Of course they're not. That implies they did something wrong. That implies they're fallible. You'll never get an American journalist to admit that.
Because another area that I've also noticed this, I want to get your take on it, is, right, I know you often make the point, which I think is a very apt one, which is one of the most disheartening things about this, like, trial by Twitter or mob, is that tack they all take, which goes, I mean, you phrase it best as, like, this, they get you at your worst, and that is just who you really are, and they've exposed you. And even if the joke is every other day of your life, you were a totally different person. No, they've got, you know, they've got the snapshot, and that's who you are, and they can just present that as, like, this is who he really is. And so I would say, yeah, another example of that would be, it's this line I see people keep saying, it's the equivalent of that stupid one where they go, it's not cancel culture, it's consequence culture. Then the same thing happens to them, and they go, what the hell, I'm being attacked? You're like, well, I thought it was just consequence. But magically, the rules just change, right? So the other version version of that is, I've heard this line many times, and it just doesn't make sense on the surface. The line goes like this: the good they've done doesn't outweigh the bad. And you go, right, that's actually normally an interesting, like, distinction. Yeah, we should actually look. Like, the joke with that, by the way, is that would actually apply to people like the Saudis and fucking Riot Games. Like, did making a video game that's like Dota mean a bunch of women had to be abused? No, I don't think that outweighs that personally. That's just my take. Similarly, the Saudis putting on some banging ESL tournaments doesn't really make up for whatever the fuck they're doing in their country or in the country of Yemen. You know, to me, that would be a great way to apply that. Instead, what they'll do, and you'll know this, is when they say that line, Richard, what they really mean is, oh, Thorin helping out countless women doesn't matter because of this tweet. Richard Lewis doing all these great articles and exposing criminals doesn't matter because I don't like that he blocked me. Like, it's actually used in the most childish possible way. And that line, they don't believe that. What they genuinely mean, and I know this sounds mad because when you're on Twitter, that's all there is. Everyone's on Twitter. We're all terminally online. But when you come out of it, I just think it's so mad that on Twitter, for real, the ultimate crime, the cardinal sin, really is a bad tweet. Or rather, just a tweet they don't like.
Yeah.
That's it, right?
Because what people don't realize is, like, the way they think about it, and again, this is a very esports thing, is, right, they think the Twitter account is you, but what they actually do in their brain is that it's an avatar of you. It's like, it's no different than, like, creating an account in Fortnite or, you know, any video game where you have a picture, you have a username, right? And you say things, and there's no body language, but it can be if you use video, but then, you know, the videos are short, because they have to be, and so you get this, like, vague, ephemeral sense of somebody's opinions about something in a moment, often when you're not ready to hear an opinion that conflicts with your own, because it's a happening, and it's super important you're on the right side, you know, that no time for sober reflection. You know, we got bad things to stop, right? So what ends up happening there with the reason a bad tweet becomes the fucking worst sin you can possibly commit in the eyes of the mob is because they believe that you are a construct. The rest of the time, when you're nice, when you're good, which should be everyone's default state, right? That's the presupposition that everybody should be an altruistic, empathetic, kind human being. Of course, like, the reality, no, hardly anyone is actually like that in the real world. You know, if you've ever grown up in hardship, you know it comes down to me and my own when the chips are down, right? But on the glorious utopia of the internet, populated by Zoomers that fortuitously, and I'm talking middle to upper class Zoomers that fortuitously don't know any different. Remember, we are talking predominantly about America and Britain and Europe. They believe everybody should be absolutely perfect, rainbow shooting out your ass, you know, heart shooting out your eyes, do no wrong, do no harm. Everything you say is always on the right side of every argument ever. Then when you aren't that, it can be at your worst moment. It can be just an opinion you have. You can just differ from consensus in some very minor way. What they believe is the mask has slipped. You were never a good guy. You were never a good person. You were never that person that everyone else should be. And I certainly am, because I can recognize it in you that you're not. And that is when the maelstrom starts up, because the concept of a mask off. Well, what do you do when there's a fucking deceiver in your midst? You've got to drive them out. They can never be trusted on anything ever again, right? Communities can't operate on lies and deception. No. In many ways, lying is some of the worst things you can do for social cohesion. And so the assumption is that because you are false, you are fake, it's not you, all of that stuff before was not real. Your life starts now at the point of what they perceive to be the real you. And they react to that, and that's what you get. That's why you get beaten down with it, because in their minds it's super important to get out somebody that might hold horrible, reprehensible thoughts, that might hold harmful thoughts about in groups, that might hold values that certainly aren't compatible with theirs. How can we ever know? You've deviated on this one thing, and everybody disagrees with you, so guess we've just got to fucking universally condemn you until the end of time. We know who the real you is now. And that's pretty much what goes on in all of those mob attacks, I think, you know.
Because this comes to what I actually think is a really interesting topic that we actually couldn't have discussed in the past episodes because we had a different perspective and esports had a different standard, which is the idea of gatekeeping. Like, you'll know where I am on this. I'm in a similar position to you. When things were awesome in esports, and quite frankly, the idea of a bad actor was just like a slightly dodgy businessman or a liar, you know, like, it wasn't really that bad back then, it seemed, right? When that was what the scene was like, I used to be one of those people who, I was a bit hippie, I was just sort of like, hey man, let's not gatekeep anyone, let's just let everyone, like, do their own thing, and you can disagree, but you know, whatever. And what the joke was, I used to be battling against gatekeeping because I saw it as like the dreaded SJWs are trying to stop us all, etc. But the joke is, I actually realized in principle they're right. You should gatekeep really dangerous elements out of esports. The problem is, obviously, I disagree with who the targets are, and I certainly disagree with who they allow to stay. So the sad thing is, I actually realize it's not just the journalists on the scene that didn't learn the lessons of games journalist fucking Vietnam. It's us. We also didn't. Like, we were actually slow.
No one learned anything.
Yeah. Because here's the sad thing. I'll give you a really good distinction of what I'm talking about here. What I realize now is we really should have, like, very aggressively, like 5-7 years ago, tried to gatekeep certain people out of positions and certainly the industry itself. Because I'll give you an example. Anyone who thinks this is some petty thing, I'm not talking about Sir Scoots or Foscorin or Frankie. Like, all these people are legit esports people who have a reason to be here. They have a job. They have a history. They're from esports. And I just disagree with them on actually sometimes quite minor things that won't really even matter in the grand scheme. I'm not talking about these people. I'm talking about when you see the people who are only there to exploit the industry. They are only there to sometimes tell lies about people. They are only there to push a certain political narrative. And the reason why I always get a bit nervous about this, not for myself, I've been through the wars. It's, I always just think of the next 18-year-old stupid kid who's going to roll out of bed and say the wrong thing, gets all life ruined.
Yeah.
This is going to be forever for him. You know, like, I always think that to myself as well, mate. I got to have a career before this started all this scrutiny. The other guy won't. He'll be labelled like that from day one. Richard, like we're saying, his worst moments at 17, and he's trying to be 27, trying to do legit work, and people are bringing it. So, what do you think on this topic?
Examples of that.
The gatekeeping one.
For me, the gatekeeping one's interesting because the concept that gatekeeping is bad is really silly, and gatekeeping is a negative term is a very recent development, and I think it's quite telling when people use it to say, if someone says to you, "Oh, gatekeeping's bad," right? It's like, well, what do you mean by that? Because because another word for gatekeeping, by the way, is safeguarding. Okay, so for like people that we don't believe are appropriate to be around children for whatever reason, criminal past, right, or worse. You have to do a very detailed criminal reference background check to even work in a school. And those, after the terrible murders at Soham, that level of scrutiny only got increased. Never heard anyone in my life say, "It's just a school, man. Why are we gatekeeping people from a school, man?" Like, no, definitely gatekeep people from a school. Definitely keep children safe. Yeah, I'm all about that life. So, you know, that's just one example. There's loads I could use. I won't, for brevity's sake. But the in esports particularly, you have to think about what esports is. And okay, so esports is a space populated by teenagers, some cases children, but teenagers and young adults, many of whom, because they all come from very diverse, wide-reaching backgrounds. Yes, you could probably say that traditionally the middle-class white male demographic is dominated, but I think we all know that I'd be very interested to see what a breakdown of an esports audience looks like now, because I know, you know, just from my own experience, it's very, very different to what it was when two decades ago. So, you know, very, very different backgrounds, different strata, different sexualities, different genders, different race, different nationalities. It's a huge melting pot of young adults. One of the things that I do think a lot of the young adults will have in common, though, is because esports is what interests them. It's what gets them passionate. What that requires is you socialize through digital means as opposed to external means. And I think it's fair to say, although no doubt people will be mega critical at this point, I'm over it, I think the average esports fan is under-socialized relative to their age. That's my read on it. You know, like I say, I've met 19 and 20 year olds that behave like 14 and 15 year olds. I know you've made the point about players, like, what is it, the Thorin rule, it's just subtract four or something, is it?
Five, you take five off the number, okay. Yes. Same concept, yeah.
And you know, there's a reason that older boomer types like you and me are arriving at this conclusion, because it wasn't always this way. So now that we have that audience, what does that audience engage with? Well, it engages with largely unfiltered, unfettered internet content on Discords, on forums, private forums, Twitter DMs, Reddit, you know, YouTube, Instagram. And they are very, very, you know, susceptible to being influenced by influencers. That's the key to the business model. You know, that's why we have all these horrible stories that come out about, you know, Minecraft YouTubers and stuff like this. There are predators on that upper tier level, that take advantage of the naivety of our key audience. And then beyond the individual stuff, you then have huge corporations that specialize in creating technology designed to manipulate your feelings, to shorten your attention span, to make you more frustrated in a game, so you might pay more for an in-game item or an upgrade, but somehow also keep the dopamine hits coming, so you play as much as you can. And all the time they're developing this, then the people who invest in those corporations, governments that are, on one hand, they're just going to fuck with your privacy, like the American government. They're just going to fuck with your privacy and just harass you. Or Saudi and China, they're going to fucking imprison you. Right, and that's that. They're the money men, you know, that are in the top now. And I'm missing out loads of other little off ramps, but the point is this: how can you tell me that in the esports industry, thus structured, gatekeeping could ever be bad? Especially if you add into that mix a derelict press, a derelict journalist corps that are asleep at the wheel and can only react, never be proactive. How can you not want to gatekeep that space? Because I'll tell you, all of the significant things that happened in my life, you know, including the passing of Maria, it's all linked to this, and it's linked to the idea that there is shit going on in the shadows, and no one wants to look, because as long as what's out front is fine, as long as the circus has the juggling man outside, no one really cares about how the, you know, bearded lady's being treated behind the scenes. They don't give a fuck. And that's the fundamental problem. Gatekeeping, sadly, is essential. And this idea, this concept of gatekeeping becoming a bad thing has led to untold harm, in my opinion. There are so many negative entities in the space, both collectively and individually, and there's loads of young adults that are going to get put into this grinder and are going to get hurt. So no, I'll never subscribe to the idea gatekeeping's bad. For me, it's more important than just you letting some wanker journalist with fucking blue hair that just spouts fucking, you know, just calls you a fucking Nazi all day. You're like, fuck off, I'm so over that, by the way. I couldn't give a fuck about all of that crew. They're an embarrassment to themselves. It's all dated so badly on both sides, by the way, frankly.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
You know, but it's, you know, the anti-SJW content of 2015 is cringe as fuck, but you know, when you look back at it. But there was something going on culturally that needed to be recorded and addressed and assessed, and that was just the medium through which people did it. But the bottom line is, yeah, for me, gatekeeping has now become about stopping Neom, stopping Saudi, stopping China, stopping predators, stopping mediocre executives, you know, being pandered to by people who want money and favors from them, so nobody actually turns over the stones about all the horrible shit that they do for 10 years when they've got a fucking, you know, line of victims as long as my arm. So, yeah, more gatekeeping, if anything, frankly.
You referenced earlier the infamous PC Game Zen article where they attacked me and you. And the whole point of the article was literally the idea that, like, we cannot be allowed to represent esports, which, by the way, isn't as simple as just represent. The implication was be in esports. Like, we should just essentially, like, be instantly driven out of the village and told, like, there's your marching orders, fuck off. Now, the reason I bring this article up, though, is sadly, I actually do sort of view that time period. If people don't know, this article came out towards the end of 2017. It was just after I won the esports award. I think it was even just a response to that, if you know who the people we do, the people behind the scenes who sort of nudged that journalist to do it. Like, spoiler, there were people mad triggered that me and Richard get to win that award, basically, because we are the bad man TM, so we had to be stopped, much like the aforementioned T character that you mentioned earlier. There's a lot of that in it. So the thing I would say is this: unfortunately, that era, 2017, 2018, I actually think for me marks, like, when I see as, like, the Rubicon that we're never going to go back over, which goes like this. At the time, one thing that was very heartening about that article was the response. You remember this? Almost every single esports industry figure who commented on it commented along the lines of, like, leave these guys alone. They're legit. They're part of esports. Even if they didn't agree with us. Like, at the time, if people don't know, I already was on the outs with Frostgurren at that point in time. We already didn't talk anymore. She might have even had me blocked on Twitter or something. Even she came out and said, like, I know Richard Lewis. Like, I've hustled with Thorin. Even she did a tweet. Like, at the time, the actual distinction was, are you esports, like I was saying earlier, are you a real part of the industry, or are you just some fucking Johnny-come-lately? That was the line in the sand that at the time people drew. The problem I have is this. The joke is, Richard, half the people who defended us would now be the ones with the pitchfork leading the mob against us now. They're the ones who suddenly agree. And I feel like basically before, and this ties into what you were saying about the old SJW dynamic. Before, the vibe in esports was, yeah, it was a little bit more towards the anti-SJW side. And so actually the vibe back then was like, ah, don't worry about, like, a few, you know, vocal minority, small voices that are screaming about something. In fact, back then people used to just laugh at people like that. Like, that joke Semler made when the ESL Impact thing was launched, where he did that harmless joke of, like, when's the men's only tournament? By the way, that's like a fucking 1 second throwaway joke that, even if you're offended by it, how could you really be that offended? You know what I mean? It's such a fucking shit.
He also did break Richard's second rule of Twitter: if you want to make a serious point, don't put a joke in the middle, because people's brains can't handle it.
That's true. But basically, people did, like, treat that. They talk about it now like it was Pearl Harbor, mate. Like, they go back up, and can you remember when he did that? As though, like, doing that means, you know, you could never ever have a serious point about anything. Like, the joke is, though, mate, there wasn't loads of people then going, like, well, calm down, it's a bloody joke. Now everyone was sort of like either silence, because I've noticed the new thing now is no one defends you, because that just means they get attacked. And now, mate, the amount of people, the mob just gets in order. Like, it went from, it was a tiny group of people, it was this person never stops tweeting about it. Now it's like, it's a faceless, unlimited number of people in the mob, it feels like. So what do you think? Do you have a similar sense? Do you think the pendulum could go back the other way, as they say? What's your sense in this regard?
It's really hard for me to sort of engage with that, because almost like answer the question, because my thoughts about esports are simply this: that the esports we knew and what we wanted to gatekeep and make into a place that was, you know, welcome for everybody, because we ourselves were outsiders when we came in.
Yes, absolutely.
So, which people never understand. We you and I were working class, boisterous by esports standards, guys that both of us wanted to inject a fucking dose of reality into what was an incredibly, you know, back then, niche interest. And, you know, we were not welcomed at all. I mean, my experience, again, I was writing about an unpopular game. I was bribed and offered opportunities if I wouldn't write about it and would come across. And if I, why won't you come to a big website, Richard? Don't want to, you know, and okay, well, you know, and again, I had one person in the industry literally have me removed from an award listing after they told an outrageous lie about me. So the idea, by the way, that we were the old boys club on day one when esports was founded, that's nonsense. But now, you know, for me, where esports is, and I've said it many times, it's not esports anymore. It's something else. It's got esports elements to it, but it's something else. And I don't care about being pushed out of this scene, or, you know, I don't want to fight for it. It's not worth saving at this point. It's over. I can still enjoy aspects of it, but you know, look, the people who are in charge of it, the people that engage in the type of behavior you're talking about, they're not the people that are running esports. Very often, those are desperate attempts to sort of, you know, synthesize relevance.
Yeah, that's actually, by the way, you're very on point there in the sense that one thing I observed myself, which actually made it less threatening, was like, it is almost a counter signal if you're banging on for years, like, we got to get rid of these guys. Like, spoiler, that means you obviously can't. Like, that's why you're begging everyone else to. You're right. I actually think you've got a good point there.
Yeah, but also as well, I mean, like, because so much of what drives attention right now is pick a cause, you know, whatever it might be, whether it's, you know, gay rights, trans rights, you know, racial equality, you pick a cause, and then you look for anything whatsoever that might not be, like, you know, it might be completely inaccurate, it could be a bad tweet, it could be a joke, it could be a rule that's clumsily worded, but generally something that's very easy to get fixed, and you shout about it, and then obviously everybody goes, oh shit, like it's one of those causes that, you know, American optics culture dictates that we not only must fix whatever it is, but we also have to be very vocal about it and reiterate our commitment to whatever it is. And there's this whole process that happens every time. And so there's a lot of people that know that that process has to happen every time, and they get a kick from essentially starting the process. I don't think those people are in charge of esports, though. I think those people, as I say, they're looking to create a relevancy from themselves, because that is what vibes with the kids right now. There's like this weird little off-ramp where a lot of content that kids are interested in is very watered down politics, essentially. Politics has become another kind of, it's become another type of entertainment. And very high stakes entertainment, you know, like what you and I might have had is like, who's going to win Big Brother? Now what you're seeing is very short, digestible content being put out by influencers. Who's going to win the presidency? Who's going to win this? And what they do is they tell the kids these very, like, again, super diluted politics, you know, where it's almost not even policy based, or they might only pick out one policy and they'll say, and if the Republicans win, or if the Conservatives win, or, you know, whatever it is, then all these terrible things will happen because of this policy. And they're not going to explain to them the fucking jaded reality that red or blue, it doesn't fucking matter. You, in almost every major Western country, you have a monoparty of fucking, you know, people that just do like backroom deals with all their crony mates. And basically, I've described it multiple times. It's irrelevant, but I'll do it again here. You have in America particularly, you have two criminal fraternities. You have two criminal groups, right? Two mafias. One's red, one's blue. And what they do is when they're in power, right, after they've used all the means possible to deceive the electorate into thinking it's a good idea to put them in power, they will then abuse that power as consistently as they can, change all the rules to ensure they stay in power as often as they can until the people will not tolerate it anymore. And then what they'll do is they will vote in the other criminal party and they all high-five each other on the way out of the revolving door, saying it's your turn. Let's see if you can steal from the people for 8 years. Let's see if you can control the media the way we did for 8 years. Let's see if you can brainwash the populace as effectively as we did for 12 years. And that's all it is. That's all it is. But there's this diluted, watered-down version of content now where that importance, that, you know, that need to be a part of something good, to give, to contribute, that desire to show you're a good person. People are exploiting the teenage desire to want to fit in by funneling politics into brains that realistically aren't well developed enough to truly understand the bigger picture. And so there is this offshoot of entertainment now where people look up to influencers that talk about political things. And so when you see one of these people in esports going, I distinctly remember Richard Lewis saying, well, I mean, all the outrageous lies they've told about me, don't you? I distinctly remember Richard Lewis working for a right-wing website one time. So this clearly means that he has right-wing thinking, and I won't look at any of the context around it, or blah, 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 blah. I won't look at any subsequent statements he's made about working there, or any, and everyone goes, yes, yes, queen, slay, slay, and everyone feels really good about it. They're not in charge of esports. They're doing that, so their career gets an extra 3 months, potentially at the expense of mine, but, you know, doesn't even matter. Because it's just another form of entertainment. It's another game. The people who are in charge of esports now, the games developers and the governments that fund them, that's it. And so I don't give a fuck. Like, why would I want to fight for that? What? Like, we've become a corporate plaything, the same thing that football, the same way football did. Am I going to go out and fight for Man City? I don't even want to fight for fucking Newcastle. It's a joke. It's a sick, sick joke. It's a sick joke that, you know, you're basically bombarding teenagers with villain of the day, fantastical nonsense story time, like it's the latest Harry Potter, and then you're telling them don't look over there, while a guy who literally is the same dude that sanctions dropping bombs on children in Yemen is the chairman of the board of ESL, of the Savvy Gaming Group company that owns ESL. You know, like, well, why would I don't give a fuck. You know, the best thing that could happen would be drive me out. It would be a blessing. Sure. I've got some sort of sick relationship with esports now. Like, people always joke about it. You keep saying you're retiring. Yeah, why do I keep coming back? Like, you wouldn't, like, it's like being in an abusive relationship. I just can't quit esports, no matter how many black eyes it gives me. It's sick. I need help.
Money doesn't grow on trees, and believe it or not, just watching a video for free with the odd ad doesn't really pay the bills. So thanks to the following people for kindly supporting my work and this particular content. And those people are, of course, Ahmed Haju, Matt Pugnaccio Rakula, Animosity, Butt Pounder 420, Jensen Gore, Kovacevic, Tobias Bernasconi, Tosh, Toucan, and a special thanks always goes out to Jerky's Minion, my main man. You know what? There are plenty of perks to be found on my Patreon, like you can find out who upcoming guests are for my reflections, interviews and talk shows. You can ask me a question in my monthly AMA. Might get roasted if it's a bit spicy in how you phrase it. You can figure out which pieces of content I might want to do next. I often ask people which they think between certain ideas, offer suggestions. You can even take part in one of those long discussions with me about all kinds of esports, whatever's on your mind. So if any of those sound like something that takes your fancy, put your money where your mouth is. Join the Scrumminati today via the Patreon link in the description below.